Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. Well, last night it took a lunar eclipse and a red sock, literally a bloody red sock, on the ankle of Curt Schilling, but a curse has been lifted. The Red Sox are the World Series champions, something that hasn't happened in 86 years. And I'm confident, well, semi-confident, I have to admit I'm a little nervous, but I do believe a curse will be lifted in only 5 days when Americans go to the polls and remove a far bigger threat to our country, this administration. This administration, of course, was installed by the United States Supreme Court, quite an unwelcome gift, done over the heads of we the people who voted for somebody else, both in the United States and in Florida. And in 5 days, the American people will have, for the first time in 8 years, a chance to freely and fairly elect the President of the United States. And I hope and pray for the sake of my country that the United States Supreme Court does not intervene. I hope and pray they've learned their lesson. They need to know that while George Bush is going around talking about how Americans will fight and die for democracy in Iraq, there are even more Americans who will fight and die for democracy in America. The United States Supreme Court should learn its lesson since day out of this election. Whether they will or not, I don't know. But I know this. If the United States Supreme Court chooses our president, and the president chooses the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court again chooses our president, and he again or she chooses the Supreme Court, that is a recipe for tyranny. That is how dictatorships work. That is not my country, and it is not something I will defend. Look, the Supreme Court is very important. We just heard that Chief Justice Rehnquist, has thyroid cancer. And so the next president of the United States, whether John Kerry or George W. Bush, will have a special opportunity to appoint probably not one, probably at least two Supreme Court justices, quite possibly three. And I think when you go to the polls, it's important to decide based on what a Kerry court would look like and what a Bush court would look like. And coming up in about 20 minutes or so, I'm going to have my guest, Peter Montgomery from the People for the American Way, and he's going to discuss with us what a Kerry court would look like, what a Bush court would look like. But I'll tell you this, of this I am sure, a Kerry court would allow Americans to choose the President of the United States. A Kerry court would respect we the people. And indeed, two of the Republican justices on the Supreme Court, there are seven Republican justices and two Democratic justices, two of those justices also respected American freedom. Two Republican justices and the two Democratic justices agreed, those four, that we should have a right to choose the President of the United States. As you well know, five of the justices, all Republicans, overruled that right, said that Americans had no right to choose their president, and because George Bush's brother, Jeb Bush, had done such an awful job running the state of Florida, and because Catherine Harris, Secretary of State of Florida, was so busy campaigning for Bush that she didn't have the time to create a standard for voting, well, they messed it up. So they're not going to count 170,000 votes in Florida. And by the way, George Bush is your president. We cannot let that happen again. We won't let that happen again. As I said, if people will fight and die for democracy in Iraq, you just wait and see what we will do for democracy in America. The Republicans are out to prevent democracy in America. I know that's an extraordinary charge, but look at the facts. Things that really we're not reporting much elsewhere, only reporting here on the Inside Scoop. But they're coming out. They're coming out front page of the Washington Post. The Republicans tried to prevent 35,000 black voters in Ohio from voting. They had no reason to believe that these black voters couldn't vote. There was no allegation even that they committed a felony or they were in the wrong district. They had nothing on them. But they determined to take a list of 35,000 almost exclusively African American voters and try to remove them from the voting list. Here was the plan. They would go in on Election Day in Ohio and challenge each and every one. When you do that, what does it do? It causes the lines to back up. It causes people who lead busy lives to say, you know what, I just don't have time to vote today, and to go home. Now, my friends, is this really so different from what the Ku Klux Klan did 50 years ago? I mean, do you know the history of the South? I assume you do. They had poll taxes to prevent poor black people from voting. They said, well, you want to vote? You got to pay this very large tax. Oh, if you're white, you don't have to pay the tax. Not if your grandfather was a citizen. Well, those clauses, called grandfather clauses today, were all about saying that poor whites could vote because, hey, their grandfathers were there before the Civil War, back when whites were citizens and blacks weren't. So they could vote. They didn't have to pay the poll tax. Blacks, they have to pay the poll tax. They have to pass a literacy test. They have to walk past throngs of jeering people trying to intimidate them and risk losing their job in their community. They're up to it again, my friends. The Republicans are up to it again, and they're not even embarrassed about it. They're not even embarrassed that in Florida they have lists of black names going in there, watching people, trying to intimidate them, trying to prevent them from voting. Well, I have a message for them. We will not be intimidated. And don't you let yourself be intimidated. If you go into a polling place, first you should check your precinct, because Florida and Ohio and a number of other states have determined that if you go in the wrong precinct, you lose your right to vote. Now, that makes no sense, obviously. In California, if you go in the wrong precinct, you can't vote for the local precinct dog catcher. But if you're in the same state, you can vote for senator, governor, and yes, president of the United States. Florida and Ohio believe, no, if you walk across the precinct line, or even worse, if the precinct line has been changed, if you vote in the same place every year, but then they change it out from under you, and you continue to vote in the same place, you lose your right to vote. Sorry. For them, voting is not a privilege or a right of citizenship. It's a test, much like the literacy tests used to keep out black voters well into the 1960s. And if you fail the test or they manage to cheat you out of your vote, ha ha, you lose. Sorry, play again another time. That's their view. Well, my friends, check carefully. Check carefully what your precinct is. Before you go to vote, go check your local registrar. If you're listening to me on the internet, it's very easy to do. Just Google registrar elections in your home state, whatever that name is. Look it up. Put in your address. Double, triple check your precinct. And if you go in the right precinct and they won't let you vote, you cause a fuss. You tell them you have an absolute right to vote. You are an American citizen. And at the very, very least, you have a right to vote provisionally. That is an absolute right to vote under federal law. Now, it'd be better if you don't vote provisionally, because then, hey, all the Republicans, they can challenge your right to vote, and rest assured they will. As a Democrat, I can assure you, I'm a lawyer, I'll be working in Virginia to help all Americans vote. I don't care whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. Sure, I want to see John Kerry win, but I want to see the rights of Americans to vote be protected more. And so I will protect everyone's right to vote. And I'm going down to the polls in Virginia on Election Day in the morning. I'll come back in the afternoon and do my show. I'm going to make sure that if somebody walks out of a polling place and they've got a long face and they don't have an I voted sticker on and they say some Republican poll watcher told me I couldn't vote, I'm going to ask, are you an American citizen? I'm going to ask, are you registered to vote? And if they say they are, then we will go back in and demand that that person have a right to cast their ballot. Many states don't require ID. Some do. Learn your state's rights. Know your rights. And if you have a right to vote and they say that you don't, or if you just go in to vote and they say you can't vote and you know you're in the right precinct, you demand a right to vote, at least a right to vote provisionally. If they refuse, you cause a ruckus. I've seen this. I've done this. I've been an election attorney. You cause a ruckus. You say quite loudly, they are denying my right to vote. You say loudly, Americans fought and died for my right to vote, and I'm not going to let any poll watcher deny my right to vote. And if you try to kick me out, I'm calling the police. Now, we can deal with this nicely. You'll either let me vote, or you racist bastard, you know, I'll sue you. I'm going to go to the ACLU. You can call 888-OUR-VOTE, O-U-R-V-O-T-E. Call your local Democratic Party. Hey, call your local Republican Party, though I really doubt any Democrat will try to prevent you from voting, because that's not what we're doing as a party. but the Republicans are out to prevent you from voting, and we can't let them do that. We cannot let them do that. Meanwhile, again, the president's going around telling us that Iraq is worth the sacrifice, saying in effect that 1,100 American lives lost, 6,000 or 7,000 wounded Americans, grievously wounded, people who've lost limbs, 20 or 30,000 dead Iraqi civilians, a war that's cost $225 billion and counting, that they originally said would cost less than $2 billion. Oops, they're 100 times off. That all of this was worthwhile because we had to find Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. Oops, didn't find us. Okay, it was worthwhile because Iraq helped Al-Qaeda do 9/11. Oops, no evidence of that. No, the reason why we went to war in Iraq, well, it was for Iraqi democracy. Yeah, there's some 60 other nations across the globe where the people aren't free, but we're going to free Iraq, and it has nothing to do with the fact that Iraq has the second largest oil supplies. That's a mere fortuitous coincidence. That's all it is. But we will fight and die for democracy in Iraq. What we won't do is fight for democracy at home. No, George Bush doesn't believe in democracy at home. No, at his rallies, he is aggressively going out and arresting people who have the audacity to show up with tickets to hear the president, believing that they had a right of free speech. I mean, Americans, imagine the audacity, the chutzpah of Americans who actually, they go to a Bush rally and they think that they are free to wear a t-shirt expressing their views. How wrong they are. Maybe one day that'll be allowed in Iraq, though I doubt it, but it certainly isn't allowed in America. Charleston, West Virginia. Nicole Rank went to hear George W. Bush speak. They had tickets, and they wore t-shirts. One said, "Love America." One said, "Hate Bush." One said, "Regime change starts at home." Staffers approached them, told them to take off those shirts or leave. Then the police came. Again, told them to take off their free speech expression, their t-shirts. They refused, and they were handcuffed, expelled from the event, roughly thrown into prison. And on that day, George Bush spoke, saying, quote, "On the 4th of July, we confirm our love of freedom, the freedom for people to speak their minds, the freedom for people to worship as they so choose, free thought and free expression, that's what we believe," unquote. And as he's saying those words, quote, unquote, he is taking free expression and throwing it in prison. 2 days later, Nicole Rank's employer, which was the federal government, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, Nicole Rank was helping Americans deal with hurricanes and tornadoes and the threat of terrorists. Well, they fired her. They fired her because she dared to go to a Bush speech with tickets with a t-shirt. The three ranks had three t-shirts: "Love America," "Hate Bush," "Regime change starts at home." I mean, you've heard about the loyalty oaths. It goes on and on and on again. I mean, let me just give you some of these examples. I think it's important to know that this is happening time and time again. Davenport, Iowa, Glenn Wooldridge had tickets, but was wearing a small John Kerry pin. The guard roughly pushed him out of line, ripped up his tickets, told him, "We don't like your pin, get out of here." August 5th, Barbara Miller, Saginaw, Michigan. She didn't have a Kerry t-shirt on. She didn't have an anti-Bush t-shirt on. She had a pro-choice t-shirt on. She believed that women should have a right to choose what to do with their own bodies. First, the t-shirt was taken. Then, two campaign workers and a security guard ejected Miller, her husband, and their daughter from the stadium, ripped up their tickets. Sorry, they're no good anymore. August 4th, Tim Watts, Mankato, Minnesota. A security screener spotted a Kerry sticker on a wallet of one of his young sons, one of the boys, ejected the whole group. Appleton, Wisconsin, Jason Nelson was invited as a special guest to a Bush rally, but earlier that day he had attended a Kerry rally. A Secret Service agent told him to leave. September 7th, students in Lee's Summit, Missouri, were instructed they could go to a Bush rally at their school, but they couldn't wear Kerry buttons or t-shirts at their own school. And we all know that on July 31st, Dick Cheney in Albuquerque, New Mexico, insisted that ticket seekers sign a loyalty oath to the President of the United States. Now, this is unheard of. This has never happened before in American history. If anyone can show me any other example where it's happened, I would be curious. Kerry doesn't do this. Kerry, let's Bush supporters go in. We've even had college Republicans come on this show tell us that, hey, well, they're going to a Bush rally and they're going to bring flip-flops. They're going to try to, you know, mock John Kerry at his own rallies. That is their right. This is still George Bush, still a free country. We talked about math professor John Prather, who did his test, right? He wore Kerry t-shirts at Bush rallies, was kicked out of dozens of them, wore Bush t-shirts at Kerry rallies, was invited in and encouraged to change his mind. Now, why is this president so against free expression in America? Why is he so against democracy? So much that they're preventing blacks from voting. There's so much to talk about here before we even get to the Supreme Court. And the other question, of course, in addition to democracy at home, it's safety abroad. Is this a president making us safe? Now, the polls suggest that people trust George Bush to keep us safe. But as more and more information comes out on these explosives that we had, hey, we're finding out that, guess what? George Bush knew about him. Knew about him in January when the UN inspectors told him, did nothing about him. Just as George Bush knew that there was a terrorist by the name of Zarqawi and did not want to bomb his camp. We're going to talk about that more tomorrow. What is George Bush up to? Why isn't he keeping us safe? Well, apparently, he went to war for weapons of mass destruction, so those are the ones that he focused on. And the Republicans are coming back. They're saying, hey, well, there's no evidence that the explosives were there when our troops arrived. Of course, it doesn't really matter, because we could have destroyed them before our troops arrived, right? But the sad thing is the evidence is that they were there when our troops arrived. In fact, Bush won't say one way or the other. What he'll do is he'll say, oh, well, you know, Kerry is denigrating our troops by saying they didn't find these weapons. Well, they didn't find these weapons, George Bush, but that's not our troops' fault. Our troops weren't looking for these weapons. You and your commanders called it a medium priority, while the oil fields, that was a high priority. So now, who is denigrating our troops? Who is denigrating our troops? Bush is saying that our troops didn't find them, and that's true. Now, who's blaming our troops? Who gives our troops the mission? And Bush is saying, by the way, Tuesday he was asked about this issue, and Bush just glared at the reporter. Apparently he hadn't been told what to say by, you know, the guys that tell him what to say, right? But now he's saying, well, Kerry, you're jumping to conclusions when you say that I should have done something about these tons of weapons. Well, this is really amazing to me. George Bush is saying to John Kerry, you don't have all the facts, so you can't criticize me. And, by the way, I don't have all the facts either. I mean, imagine what's going on here. You got a night watchman at a bank, and he's sleeping. And you go in and you say to the night watchman, hey, all the money's gone. I think I need to replace you as night watchman. The night watchman jumps up and says, first of all, there's no evidence the money was there when I first came on the job, as if that excuses his sleeping. And then the night watchman says, you new watchman, you can't take my place. You don't have all the facts. As if it somehow carries responsibility to know where these munitions are. I'm afraid, my friends, it is Bush's responsibility to know where the munitions are. And in fact, I have a reporter who is embedded with our troops coming on tomorrow to talk about all the loose munitions throughout Iraq. But something extraordinary just came to my attention just before this show. I want to thank the people who emailed it to me. And that is a local TV station in Minneapolis apparently had embedded troops in with our troops when they were at Al-Qaqa just a few days after the invasion. And guess what, folks? Apparently there were explosives there. I want you to hear this report because it's not one that's gotten a lot of press. Listen to our report from, you know, newsmakers on Channel 5 in Minneapolis. They don't seem to have any agenda here. Listen to what they have to say about the weapons in Al-Qaqa.
The senator is making wild charges.
A bunker war brewing as the election nears.
Now our troops are at greater risk.
Senator Kerry this week seemed shocked to learn that Iraq was a dangerous place.
The face-off is on tonight over missing explosives in Iraq.
Leading with more news. You're watching 5 Eyewitness News at 10.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Cindy Bricado.
The missing explosives in Iraq may have ties to a Five Eyewitness News team that was embedded near the site in question. John Mason is here right now. Tell us what this possible connection is all about.
Cindy, the area where our crew was with the 101st Airborne, was certain to say very close to that munitions installation called Al-Kaka, which is where tons of ammunition went missing. Using GPS technology and talking to members of the 101st Airborne, we've determined that our crew may have been located on the southern edge of the actual weapons complex. Now, take a look at this map. This is an area south of Baghdad. Al-Kaka is here. Our crew was embedded with the 101st a little further south right there. On the day the video you're about to see was shot, they drove north 2 to 3 miles to what very well might have been Al-Kaka. The video was shot on April 18th after the fall of Baghdad, in the middle of a time span that is now an issue in the presidential campaign. Members of the 101st Airborne Division took our crew to look at bunker after bunker of material labeled explosives.
There we go. Now we can get in there.
Usually it took just the snap of a bolt cutter to get in and see this material identified by the 101st as detonation cords.
We can stick it in those and make some new bunkers.
And after the doors were open to those bunkers, they weren't secured. They were left open when our crew and the military went back to their base. There were what appeared to be fuses for bombs, bags of material men from the 101st couldn't identify, but box after box clearly marked explosive. And in one bunker, boxes marked with the name of the munitions plant in question, where tons of explosives allegedly went missing. Al-Kaka. Photojournalist Joe Caffrey shot this video.
We weren't quite sure what we were looking at, but we saw so much of it. And it didn't appear that this was being secured in any way. It was several miles away from where all the military people were staying in their tents.
What do you think, America? Is this a big bomb or what?
Officers with the 101st tell us tonight these bunkers were within the U.S. military perimeter, protected. But photojournalist Caffrey and former Five Eyewitness News reporter Dean Staley, who spent 3 months in Iraq, say Iraqis were coming and going freely.
At one point, there was a group of Iraqis driving around. There was a group in a pickup truck, three or four guys, that we kept an eye on from a distance, worried that they might come near us.
There is criticism and confusion over when explosives vanished from the Al-Kaka ammunitions installation, before or after the fall of Saddam on April 9th. What we know from this video is on April 18th, 9 days after the fall of Baghdad, in bunkers either very near or actually on Al-Kaka, there was material labeled explosives, some of it identified by members of the 101st Airborne as explosives, with questionable levels of protection around them. Again, our crew's recorded position, according to GPS equipment, puts them just south or on the southern edge of Al-Kaka. Officials with the 101st we talked to tonight agree with that. Now, we've emailed pictures of the material that we found to experts in Washington tonight to see if it is the same kind of high explosives that went missing in Al-Kaka. They couldn't say. We plan to get our tape to experts tomorrow as we continue to follow this story. But be clear, based on the descriptions of the material in question in the video that we brought you tonight, the explosives may or may not be the material, the explosives in question.
What they certainly are is part of this presidential campaign. Reports of the missing explosives now playing a part in the race for president. John Kerry lashed out at President Bush while in Rochester today.
You didn't think it was important. You didn't check for them. You didn't give the troops the instructions they needed. You didn't put enough troops on the ground to do that job. You didn't guard the ammunition dump, and now our troops are at greater risk.
Kerry made those statements to about 7,500 people at the Mayo Civic Center. In Ohio, President Bush accused John Kerry of rushing to judgment.
The senator is making wild charges about missing explosives when his top foreign policy advisor admits, quote, we do not know the facts.
The president said military authorities are investigating the possibility that Saddam's regime removed the explosive before coalition troops arrive.
And Cindy, once again, we know we have work to do on this. We are sending a copy of our videotape to explosive experts near Washington, D.C. for them to have a first-hand look.
And hopefully we'll get some kind of follow-up on this by tomorrow.
We're working on it.
We'll check.
Well, if they do get a follow-up by tomorrow, I'll be reporting it. Note again, George Bush will not say what happened to those weapons because he doesn't know and he's complaining that John Kerry doesn't know what happened to him. The guy guarding the bank is blaming someone who wasn't there who wants to replace him for not knowing what happened. Why were we asleep on the job? Does it matter? Does it matter, really, whether they were there or not? Channel 5 says they were there. But in some sense, it doesn't matter because we weren't guarding it anyway. We weren't guarding it. As late ago as Sunday, they were still looting the installations. And this is the president that's going to care about our security? This is the president that's an aggressive? By the way, the same president sending out his Secretary of State, Colin Powell, to complain that Israel shouldn't take action against Iran's nuclear weapons. Israel, as you might recall, is the reason why Iraq does not have nuclear weapons today. They destroyed the Osirik nuclear plant back in 1982. And apparently, Colin Powell is trying to restrict Israel's right to do that. Now, look, it's another issue. There's too much to discuss today. But if you want to call in, you can talk about this too. It seems to me that there's a big difference between a democracy having nuclear weapons and a dictatorship. And when a dictatorship has nuclear weapons, you have every right to take it out. We went to war in Iraq, Bush says, because Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons that Bush knew he didn't have, that Cheney knew he didn't have. And now they're sending Colin Powell out saying, Israel, don't protect us from Iran's nuclear weapons? Doesn't make any sense for Israeli security or for ours. There is some good news, though, and hey, maybe you think I'm harsh, but I don't. I'm very glad to hear that Yasser Arafat is ill. I think if Yasser Arafat dies soon of natural causes, it'll be the best thing for peace in the Middle East. I have no sympathy for the man. He is a terrorist. He did many times bomb schools, tried to kill little children. No sympathy for the man. He's also clearly a threat to peace in the Middle East. He's the one that's very much keeping the Palestinians from working with the Israelis, and I think many Palestinians do want peace and do want a separate state. Just read Bill Clinton's book, and you'll find that Arafat was in the way again and again and again, that he alone prevented that peace agreement. I'm glad he's sick. I hope he dies of natural causes, and I hope no one tries to make it into some conspiracy against Israel, though I'm sure some will. Some will. Better not to kill him. Let him die soon of natural causes. Boy, I've got way too much to talk about, and we still got to get to my guest and the Supreme Court, and we got to get to your calls. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Whether you want to talk about the explosives or the elections or Arafat or, most importantly, the Supreme Court, I want you to call in 877-57-SCOOP. When we come back, we're going to have Peter Montgomery from People for the American Way, and he's going to explain to us the difference between a Kerry Supreme Court and a Bush Supreme Court. That and more right after these messages.
Skeptical if you took your car in for a routine checkup and the repair shop said it had found a mysterious and costly problem deep in the engine that, quote, needs fixing, even though you can't detect any problem at all. Welcome to the shady world of today's Social Security mechanics, including politicos of both parties and a phalanx of banking lobbyists. They're telling us in the direst terms that there's a major problem deep in the Social Security system that must be fixed right away. The fix is going to be costly, they solemnly inform us. It'll require raising people's retirement age to as high as 70, cutting the monthly payments for all retired workers, and even privatizing part or all of this public safety net for retirees. But we must accept these fixes, they warn, or the whole system will sputter and die. BS alert, BS alert. Of all government programs, including the bloated, fraud-ridden Pentagon, Social Security is least in need of fixing. It's the most efficient program we have, requiring a mere 1% of its total budget for administrative costs. And even the political mechanics who want to mess with the program admit that Social Security is perfectly sound and capable of paying full benefits to future retirees through at least 2042. What insurance company or bank can make that claim? And with only minor adjustment, the system is solid through 2075, long after most of today's fixers will be dead. There is one fix, however, that would guarantee the soundness of Social Security in perpetuity. Raise the current $88,000 income cap so that the salaries, bonuses, stock gains, and other wealth of the elites are also subject to Social Security taxes, rather than keeping the burden solely on the wages of low-income and middle-class working folks. This is Jim Hightower saying, to push for this simple and fair reform, call Campaign for America's Future, 202-955-5665.
38%.
46%.
42%.
I cut my payments in half.
How much can you cut your monthly student loan payments by refinancing with College Loan Corporation? To find out, just call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will answer your questions and tell you how you can cut your monthly payment by up to 50% by refinancing your federal student loans at rates as low as 2.63%. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. It is 5 days before Election Day, 5 days before the first chance Americans have had in 8 years to freely and fairly determine the President of the United States. And, of course, the reason we didn't have that opportunity 4 years ago is the United States Supreme Court stepped in and made the decision for us. My guest, Peter Montgomery from People for the American Way, is going to tell us the difference between a Kerry Supreme Court and a Bush Supreme Court. And if you want to call in and ask questions, all you have to do is call toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. And you can also contribute to the blog. All you have to do is go in at www.radioinsidescoop.com, put your questions, comments, challenges to me, and we're going to try to address those as well. First, let me welcome my guest, Peter Montgomery. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I want to ask you, what is the choice in terms of our Supreme Court? I mean, there's some that argue, some that might vote for Ralph Nader, that it's not that big a difference between Bush or Kerry. They're both in league with corporate interests. How would the Supreme Court change if Kerry, rather than Bush, appointed the next justice of the Supreme Court?
Well, it's really a huge difference, and it's well beyond the next justice. Given how long the current justices have been on the court and how long it's been since the vacancy, we're really talking about appointing the next two or three or four justices. So you have to have a much bigger view of how long-lasting that's going to be and how wide-ranging the impact is. And President Bush has told us, told people while he was campaigning in 2000 and has repeated, the kind of justices that he's going to put on, the models that he's citing, are Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas. Now, Scalia and Thomas are not just conservative. They are, you know, aggressive far-right activists. You know, they're even to the right of Chief Justice Rehnquist. And they're always out there pushing the court, trying to push the court further to the right. So if we had, you know, one, two, or three more justices like that on the court, it would be a staggering impact and could really, you know, overturn decades of social justice progress and legal protections that have been, you know, were fought hard for and Americans have enjoyed for decades.
Now, Peter, Bush goes on the stump and he argues that it's liberals, it's Democrats, it's people like John Kerry that want activist judges, judges that won't obey the law, won't obey the Constitution, that come out with far-flung, crazy interpretations. Would you say that Rehnquist, Scalia, Thomas, are they the kind of judges that strictly adhere to the limits of the law?
Certainly not. As you cited, they had some very creative reasoning in Bush v. Gore 4 years ago, somehow magically applying it to that one special scenario and not wanting to apply equal rights to any other equal protection to other elections. But they also, you know, Bush uses the language you talked about, you know, constructionism, following the law. These guys want to turn back the Constitution to the way the Constitution was looked at in the 19th century, back to before the New Deal. So we're talking about no constitutional right to privacy, radically rolling back the ability of the federal government to
protect the environment, enforce individual rights, enforce constitutional rights. It's really a radical rollback of the constitutional framework that we've been operating under for seven decades in this country.
Let me go right to the phones if I could. I'm sure lots of people have questions for you. Welcome to the Inside Scoop, caller. You're with Mark Levine and Peter Montgomery.
Yeah, the Supreme Court would be yet another step in the direction of a ruling class and peasants without rights. I had called in before your guest had arrived, though, and I was wanting to get a clarification, if I might, on these explosives in Iraq.
Okay, go ahead.
I couldn't hear clearly the tape that you had played there, but UN inspectors had these explosives in their custody and secure when the UN inspectors were ordered to leave by, I understand, the Secretary of Defense.
That's correct. And, the UN inspectors, including Mohammed Al-Baradei, reported they were there with the seals intact as recently as January 2003. And they were watching over them. That's correct.
And the UN inspectors didn't want to leave until they had somebody covering the explosives. They saw the risk there.
That's correct. But we ordered them out and said we were going to take care of it ourselves. They wanted to stay in. As you may recall, they wanted to finish the inspections, give inspections a chance. That, in fact, was what many people in Congress argued. In fact, what the president originally said when he sought war authorization, he said, I need this in a way to put pressure on Saddam Hussein, but we'll let inspectors have a chance.
Well, Mark, it seems to me, as I'm able to piece this together, is that all of our forces, largely led by the Halliburton crew, had one primary goal, and that was to grab control of the oil industry of Iraq. They probably couldn't spare or didn't have time. I can't even tell, and I don't know if you know, were any of the generals even informed of the explosives at Al-Qaqa?
Oh, absolutely. Our generals were absolutely informed. In fact, there are, and if you go through, and we don't have time to go into too much detail because I want to get some other callers, but if you go through and read the New York Times story on this, and also reports in the Washington Post, L.A. Times, it's clear that the United Nations warned our defense people. Now, again, maybe they didn't get it across to the generals. We do know that the people at the bottom didn't know, that the people, the 101st Airborne, had no idea. They were told this is a medium priority. You heard this, I don't know, maybe it was hard to hear, the Channel 5 report saying that they were told it wasn't that important, and the high priority was the oil fields. So, again, how far it went down the chain, we don't know, but we certainly know that people at the top, starting with the President of the United States, Security Advisor, Dick Cheney, they all knew about it. Hey, thanks very much for your call.
Thank you, Mark.
Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Peter Montgomery.
Yeah, this is 464 from Michigan.
Hello.
Yeah, I'm wondering if we can expect any lame duck antics from Bush and his boys. You think it would be possible that he could, or someone in the administration could coerce some Supreme Court justices who are on the bubble of retirement to sort of go over the edge, and so they could push through two or three real quick?
Well, it's an interesting question. Of course, it does require Senate confirmation. Let me throw it to Peter. Peter, let's say Kerry wins the election, as I certainly hope he does. Of course, there is a two-month and two-week period between when Bush would leave office and Kerry would take office. Let's say Chief Justice Rehnquist resigns on November 3rd, the day after a Kerry victory. What would you say would happen then?
Well, there's a couple things that could happen then. One is that Bush could immediately nominate someone, and presumably the Democratic senators would, you know, use the appropriate tool for the Senate to keep that person from moving forward.
A filibuster.
The filibuster. And it's possible that the Republican Senate leadership could use what they have been threatening to do over the last couple of years and do the so-called, quote, nuclear option.
Explain what that is to our listeners.
Well, there's a couple different types of it. The basic theme is that they would just abuse the raw power of leadership to change the rules of the Senate. Changing the rules of the Senate would normally require a supermajority vote, but they've concocted a couple procedural things where they could sort of, you know, bring a rule of parliamentary procedure question, can we proceed on this? They would vote along party lines, get a 51-vote majority, and really just abuse the power of the majority to change the rules of the Senate to do away with the power of the minority party to filibuster.
Now, of course, in the caller's hypothetical, Kerry has won the election, so he has the mandate from the American people.
Oh, well, and I think if they tried this, there would be an astonishing and appropriate outcry, and I think that the Senate Democrats would do everything to stop it, and I think that there are actually, I think some Senate Republicans would not go along with something like that. The other possibility that has been raised, actually, that I think Pat Buchanan, of all people, has raised, is the possibility of Kerry, if Kerry is elected, Rehnquist stepping down while Bush is still president, and that Bush would actually recess appoint someone onto the Supreme Court. He has used the recess appointment power before in this term with some lower court judges. It's never been used on the Supreme Court. But he could do that and put somebody on the court. That means that the person would not serve for life.
When would their term end?
Well, that's an interesting question, too. When you recess appoint someone, the term usually lasts until the end of the next session of Congress. So
sounds like it could only be a couple months because the next
session
of Congress.
Well, it could be a couple months, or if Bush would say wait until January when the new Congress has been sworn in. There's all kinds of interesting theoreticals you can play with.
Yeah, it does.
I wouldn't put it past, some people in the administration to want to do this. I think that there would be just a huge outcry against it because it would be such an obvious, brazen power play right in the face of the will of the voters.
Let me remind people who may not know the history that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a president far more popular than this one and someone who had a mandate, he was reelected by the voters. When the Supreme Court ruled in ways he didn't like, he threatened to pack the court, to actually add members of justices to the court. Again, he had an overwhelmingly Democratic Congress and overwhelming popular mandate, and there was such a public outcry that he dropped his plan. I would think, and this is, I guess, my answer to the caller, that this would be too brazen, even for this administration, there would be such a public outcry that it wouldn't be allowed. But it's important to watch and think about it. Let me go to another caller. If you want to call in and ask me a question or talk about the issues I raised or talk about the Supreme Court with Peter Montgomery, he's quite a scholar, all you have to do is call in 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or contribute to the blog at radioinsidescoop.com. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Peter Montgomery.
This is Ed from New York. Mr. Montgomery has raised the issue of four justices being possibly being replaced during the next term of the court. Can he tell us which four justices, and can he tell us how... what are the odds of them being replaced? What would make them want to be replaced?
Okay. Who is most likely? Now you're really predicting the future here with health and everything, but we know Chief Justice Rehnquist has thyroid cancer.
Well, yeah, and it is really speculation. Nobody really knows. I mean, there are a couple justices who've had questions about their health, including Chief Justice Rehnquist. Justice Stevens is in his 80s. Three of the other justices are in their 70s. Of course, that doesn't mean anything. That doesn't mean they're going to be ready to step down. But, you know, there was speculation even back 4 years ago that Sandra Day O'Connor was interested in retiring. Nobody really knows. These are very closely held secrets.
So Rehnquist, O'Connor, Stevens.
There has not been a vacancy on this court for more than 10 years now, and that hasn't happened since the 1820s. But more than 180 years since we've had that long of a gap.
In fact, I think the record's about to be broken. The record's 12 years, right? I think that's
right. In the early 1800s, it might have been a little longer than that. But,
okay.
But the fact is, in the last 50 years, it's been about once every 2 years. So we're long overdue just based on that historical record and based on how long some of the current justices have served and their age and health issues. It really is hard to know. It could be two, could be three. Even one or two new justices kind of in the mold of Scalia or Thomas, especially if they're young, if they're appointed relatively young justices like Thomas, you know, they could be shaping the court for the next 30 or 40 years.
So it sounds like the three you've mentioned, Rehnquist, who's, of course, Chief Justice, quite conservative, and then, of course, there's O'Connor, who's sort of definitely a Republican conservative, but not as far right-wing as Rehnquist. And then there's Stevens, who, interestingly, though appointed by Gerald Ford, a Republican, is on well, for this court is on the liberal side, or at least the less conservative Republican side, and that would really have a chance to change the court. Let's say, oh no, it'd be horrible, but let's say that George Bush is actually fairly elected this fall, which I have my questions about whether it will happen. But if he is, and say someone like Justice Stevens were to go off the court, he's 84 years old, can you give us some real concrete examples of how appointing another justice like Scalia or Thomas would change the court? Let's just go piece by piece. Let's start with abortion rights. How would that change?
Well, in abortion rights, there's a number of cases that are have been decided by one or two votes, and this is basically in a whole range of issues. Now, Roe, it's not clear exactly right now. Probably to overturn Roe, you'd need two more votes. But Justice Kennedy has gone along with some restrictions on Roe, so it's not clear exactly how much reproductive choice would be rolled back with one new justice. Certainly with two, it would be overturned because, Scalia and Thomas are eager to overturn it, and they've made that clear in all their dissents.
How about in terms of civil rights or protecting our rights from of privacy from the government, reading our mail or putting us in jail without giving us a right for charges? In terms of the Bill of Rights, basic American rights, how would a Bush versus Kerry court affect it?
Well, again, if you look, one of the things that People for the American Way Foundation did a report called Courting Disaster, and they sort of took Bush at his word that he was going to put Scalia and Thomas-type judges on. So we went through and read their opinions, read their dissents, and said, what if these were majority opinions? What if they were not writing repent? So they would reverse an application of the Voting Rights Act to elections for state judges. They would take that out of the protection of the Voting Rights Act. They would take state nominating conventions out of the protection of the Voting Rights Act.
Let me be clear on this, because the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1964 to give civil rights to blacks. Remember, we talked about this on the broadcast before you came on, Peter, and that is how blacks didn't. They had a technically legal right to vote during all those years from the Civil War to the 1960s, but because of all kinds of things, poll taxes and grandfather clauses and literacy tests, for all intents and purposes, they didn't have the right to vote, and the Voting Rights Act protects their right to vote. We know now that Republicans are doing their best to stop blacks from voting even today. I reported on some of that in my broadcast. How would a change to the Supreme Court affect the right of an ordinary African-American trying to exercise his or her right to vote in the polls?
Well, we mentioned a couple of those areas that they would sort of just say, you can't bring a voting rights challenge to, even blatantly unfair procedures in certain kind of elections, would exempt any kind of review of even the most blatant partisan gerrymandering from the courts, in terms of equal opportunity, would basically forbid any kind of affirmative action in higher education.
Let me ask you this. Let's say that the Republicans tried to intimidate black voters, and they posted police cars around, and they put up signs that said, hey, you have to pay all your parking tickets before you're allowed to vote here. And blacks said, hey, you're targeting black neighborhoods, or say Republican poll watchers do as they're trying to do in Ohio right now, and went in and challenged the qualifications of every black voter, but didn't do it for the white voters. Is that the kind of thing that you could normally do a voting rights challenge under? Is that in danger?
It is certainly the kind of thing you could do a voting rights challenge under. I don't know. I don't think that even the conservative justices on the court would say you can't bring a voting rights challenge under blatantly racial targeting of voters in federal elections. I'm hoping that even the right-wing justices would not look the other way, but we may have an opportunity to see that in the pretty near future.
I've got a comment here on the blog from Nathan, who commented on my comments earlier in the hour, where I attacked these attacks on blacks trying to vote. He said, Mark, I think you're putting too much faith in party lines. There are Republicans that will use fraud to win an election, no doubt. But you also have to show that there are Democrats somewhere in this country that think the stakes are so high that they want Kerry elected at all costs. and even being willing to commit fraud to do it, these people could be working at polls too. Nathan, my response is they could be working at polls, but let's just look at the news that's come out today. The Secretary of State that insisted that the paper be of a certain weight in Ohio to count that absentee ballot, that was a Republican. The groups that went around, the voters outreach group that went around and threw away voter registration forms, right, ripped them up, the ones that were signed by Democrats. They were paid for by the Republican Party. That's in some 10 states. In Florida, controlled by the Republicans, 58,000 votes. 58,000 votes, one-third of the votes that were not counted in the Florida election last time, are lost in Broward County. These absentee votes are just missing. Broward County is one of the most heavily Democratic counties in Florida. It contains Fort Lauderdale. Or the fact that 10,000 votes were just thrown out in Florida because although the people signed they were citizens, they didn't check the box to say they were a citizen. So these technical reasons, and guess what? Democrats were fighting to let those people vote. Republicans were trying to keep them from voting. So, Nathan, there may well be Democrats out there willing to break the laws to prevent people from voting. I'm as much against them as Republicans, but all the evidence I've seen, unfortunately, is that it's Republican Party trying to keep people from voting, and the Democrats are trying to let people have a right to vote. We have to go to commercial break, but there's still some time left to call in, talk to me, talk to Peter Montgomery. All you have to do is call toll-free 877-57-SCOOP. 877-57-SCOOP. Is the Supreme Court a reason why you will cast your ballot one way or the other 5 days from now? What are you most concerned about? How would a Kerry court look different from a Bush court? We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
I will never cede America's security to any institution or to any other country. No one gets a veto over our security. No one. I will never take my eye off Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and the terror in Afghanistan. We're going to hunt down the terrorists. We will kill them. We'll do what's ever necessary to protect America.
I'm John Kerry, and I approve this message.
Our economy needs a kickstart, beginning with jobs for America's middle class, jobs that pay more with secure and affordable health care. New manufacturing jobs by giving tax breaks for companies that create jobs here, and good high-tech jobs by growing new industries to be independent of Middle East oil. The president is satisfied with an economy of lower-paying jobs. I'm not. I believe America can do better. I'm John Kerry, and I approve this message.
I'm Michael Bednarik, and I approve this message.
President Bush got elected by claiming to be a compassionate conservative. Would a real conservative approve a half a trillion dollars in deficit spending in a single year? Would a real conservative send thousands of troops to Iraq while leaving our own borders vulnerable to both terrorists and lawless illegal aliens? Would a real conservative want to amend our Constitution 7 different ways? If you're fed up with electing Republicans who claim to be conservative and then govern like liberal Democrats, you do have an alternative. Michael Bednarik, the Libertarian candidate for president. Bush and Kerry aren't the only choices. Libertarian Michael Bednarik, the alternative for the real conservative. Visit Bednarik.org today or call 800-807-7552.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're talking about the Supreme Court under Bush or under Kerry. I did think the new Bednarik ad played here on the Inside Scoop is interesting because it shows that Libertarian candidate Michael Bednarik is actually doing better than Ralph Nader in several states out west. And it's just interesting that the Libertarian candidate is maybe the true third-party candidate in the race. But we're talking about the Supreme Court. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. 877-57-SCOOP. Is the Supreme Court a reason to vote for one candidate or the other? What does it matter in terms of our lives? My guest is Peter Montgomery. He's with People for the American Way. Peter, I want to read to you a quote I have on the blog here. It's by Rick. He writes, the Supreme Court issue is on the top of my list of important issues right after voter rights. The Supreme Court is the last line of defense for the Constitution. Since Supreme Court justices serve for pretty much life, they can have a lasting effect on the direction of the country. If George Bush is elected, I never say reelected because he wasn't elected the first time, but if he's elected in 5 days, what are some of the ways we could see a lasting effect 4, 5, 10 years from now?
Well, one thing, let me quote a little bit from New York Times columnist Adam Cohen, who wrote a column basically said, what will America look like, you know, under if Bush is able to pick the Supreme Court? Abortion might be a crime in most states. Gay people could be thrown in prison for having sex in their homes. States might be free to become mini-theocracies, endorsing Christianity and using tax money to help spread the gospel. The Constitution might no longer protect inmates from being brutalized by prison guards. Family and medical leave and environmental protections could disappear. Boom. There's one paragraph that gives a sense of the kind of things that a Scalia-Thomas-dominated Supreme Court could do. It would make it hard for people... make it hard for workers to challenge abuse by corporate or government employers, make it hard for people whose rights have been denied by the by state governments or by employers to get redress through the courts, to even have access to justice. It could make it much harder for the federal government to protect, you know, the air we breathe and the water we drink, because under the state's rights approach to the Constitution, that is favored by the Federalist Society and Scalia and Thomas and the folks in the White House and the DOJ, it's almost impossible that, you know, the federal government wouldn't have authority to act in a lot of these areas. So, you know, for people who are thinking about a third-party candidate because they're not particularly enthusiastic maybe about the other candidates, I would say think about how long this could be. You know, we could get a Supreme Court dominated by Scalia and Thomas, and then it won't matter if you elect a Congress and a president, a progressive Congress and a president, because the Supreme Court could sort of strike down as constitutional any kind of progressive legislation. And we've seen that, you know, at the early part of the 20th century.
One of the things I really want people to realize is that when George Bush says that he doesn't want activist judges, I'm afraid he's really not being candid with the American people, because the two judges he picked, Scalia and Thomas, are nothing if not activist judges. Let me just give an example based on states' rights. Conservatives will tell you they support states' rights. They will tell you that when the federal government goes in, for example, you have a state that's denying voting rights to black people, a white state, that has happened in the South, and they'll say, no, let the state choose. We believe in states' rights. Then comes issues where they don't like states' rights. One of them, I know that the medical marijuana bill passed in a number of states, and the Supreme Court said, sorry, states don't get to decide. We're going to let the federal government decide. Another case would be in the case of gay civil rights, where you have the Massachusetts Supreme Court that gave gay people the right to marry. And again, you have conservatives saying they want the federal government to trump that state's right. And, of course, the last and clearest example, and the one that I mention all the time here, of course, is the right to vote. In Florida, the people were not allowed to decide. The Florida Supreme Court is supposed to be the highest court to decide Florida law, and they ruled that all these votes would be counted, and the Supreme Court just overruled them and said no. So it's not a question of consistent judicial conservatives or supporting state rights. These are activist judges. And go ahead.
No, I just said that's exactly right. It's activist judges with a very clear ideology that they are pursuing. You know, very clear ideology to roll back the federal government, to return us to a time when the Constitution gave more authority and more priority to protecting property rights and the rights of states than it did to protecting individual liberties. And that's where they want to take us. And they are not concerned about Supreme Court precedent.
And when you say they're not concerned about precedent, give us some examples of that.
Well, I mean, it was very interesting. There was recently an article came out that of Antonin Scalia, you know, recounting a story of Thomas telling him that he didn't believe in the principle of stare decisis at all.
Well, now explain what stare decisis is.
Stare decisis is sort of a principle in the law in the Supreme Court that says, you know, because it's important to have some consistency, you know, over time, you don't want decisions changing back and forth all the time on important principles, so that even if a decision was, you know, maybe decided and it could have gone the other way, the fact that it has been decided means that you will give some weight to leaving it there and not overturning it at the first chance.
Not just try to do something because that's the way you want it, but to actually respect the law that went there before.
Right, and sort of the power of precedent. But they have in their sights, you know, dozens of precedents, actually more than 100 precedents that they would like, that Scalia and Thomas would like to overturn on their way to, you know, taking us back to before the New Deal.
Peter, we only have a few seconds left, but I do want to ask you about the question of open government, government secrecy. This administration is one of the most secretive known ever in American history. In fact, we're going to discuss a lot about this tomorrow on the Inside Scoop. What has the Supreme Court done in terms of either opening up government or allowing the Bush administration to keep things secret?
Well, I think you're right about the secrecy. You know, this kind of secrecy we've seen in this administration is unprecedented, and you know that kind of excessive secrecy is really the enemy of accountability because it's impossible to hold people accountable. I think you know the Supreme Court is probably mixed on this, and I think that.
So if we got another Bush justice, that could keep things like the Energy Commission and all the things that they're trying to keep secret.
We've seen the Supreme Court go. You know, we've seen protecting. You know, Dick Cheney's ability to keep secrets. We've seen the court sort of side a little bit more with openness on saying you can't hold U.S. citizens, you know, incommunicado without giving them some rights. But I think it's clear that we don't. If we have a Supreme Court that reflects the views of Bush and Cheney, their constitutional views and the views of the enormous power of the president to avoid accountability. You know, we'll have more secrecy.
Peter, I'm afraid our time is up. I want to thank you very much for coming here on the Inside Scoop and giving us your insights.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
And again, his points are making are very important. It's about our rights. It's about our voting rights. It's about our Bill of Rights. Government can't just go in and throw us in prison without giving us a reason. It's about open government. If you believe in democracy, the government should be accountable to the people. And I think it's pretty clear that a Kerry Supreme Court would hold that government, a Kerry government, accountable to the people because they believe in open government, while you got people like Scalia and Thomas, they just want to keep everything closed and secret. So I think it leaves a very clear choice in this election. I hope you agree with me. Tune in tomorrow. We're going to be talking precisely about secret government, all the things the Bush administration has been holding back. My guests are going to talk about classification and declassification, all the ways the Bush administration hides all those secrets that we bring you here on the Inside Scoop. And I've also got a reporter who's embedded with the troops to talk